It's Wednesday. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update for July 29th. The podcast, by the way, will change formats mid-next week. I'll have more details on that in the next few days. On today's NPR News Update, will there be a special legislative session to help Mille Lacs resorts? One law change next month deals with families in divorce situations. A Minnesota dentist is in trouble for killing an African lion. Deer hunters in the state face another fall of reduced bag limits. And Minnesota remembers the Voting Rights Act of 1965. First, an early end to the walleye season on Lake Mille Lacs may force lawmakers back to St. Paul next month. Governor Dayton is considering calling a special session to provide aid for resorts and businesses around the lake. They would face a blow if the season ends early, as expected this year. Recent surveys of walleye harvest show the lake within 3,000 pounds of reaching its annual limit set by the state. House Speaker Kurt Dowd joined Kathy Werzer to talk about it this morning.
The governor says this is a crisis situation. Do you agree a special session is needed?
Well, it definitely is concerning. We have members that represent that area who have been following the situation closely. It sounds like it may be almost a certainty that the walleye season will be closed early, and we know that will have a pretty big impact on the resorts around Lake Mille Lacs.
I was talking with the state DNR commissioner Friday night on public TV, and he indicated that while the walleye fishing season could end soon on Mille Lacs, the fishing is still good for other species in the lake. Why not wait and see what happens before calling a session?
Well, I think that may be the right course of action. I suggested to the governor in our conversation yesterday that we put together a working group of legislators from that area and also legislators who specialize in the issue areas effective tourism, natural resources, those sorts of issues, and get them around a table with the governor's commissioners and issue experts to really look at all solutions and try to think outside the box and figure out if there's a way we can solve this.
What types of aid do you think you would look at or lawmakers would look at for Mille Lacs businesses? Just straight cash or something else?
Well, the governor suggested low-interest loans and also some sort of local property tax forgiveness. I'm not sure if those will be the ultimate solutions, and I think we really need to consider anything and everything. Maybe it's the ultimate solution is something we haven't thought of yet.
How much money might we be talking about here?
Well, the governor initially indicated to me that he thought it was somewhere between 10 and 20 million worth of aid that he thought would be necessary. I think it's probably a bit too early to tell as this is kind of just unfolding now.
Couldn't this be the new normal that we're talking about? Might this set a standard for future years where the walleye season may end early as well?
Well, it potentially could, and my concern also is how are we managing the walleye population in the lake, and if we do increase the stocking of walleye in Lake Mille Lacs, of course, that takes some time for those fish to be of a size that folks can catch and enjoy catching, so this could be a situation that lasts for 3 or 4 years before we have the walleye population to a level that would allow for fishing throughout the season.
It sounds as if for you, I'm listening to you talk here, Mr. Speaker, that there are still some unanswered questions before you would agree to a special session in August.
I think that's probably accurate. We're very concerned about the situation. We want to make sure we do what's right by these resorts. We don't want to see them suffering because of this closing of the season early. But we also want to make sure we're doing the right thing, and we want to look at all options. So I'm hoping that working group can get together in the next couple of days and take a look at what the situation is, what's caused it, and ultimately, hopefully, all of the possible solutions. And let's try to find something that can provide some relief for these resorts in the best way possible. And I think we have to be creative, probably.
If there is going to be a special session, would you look at an agenda that could include disaster relief for the Brainerd Lakes area after the storms came through?
I think we absolutely would. That's kind of been the tradition that we deal with these disaster relief issues as they crop up in special sessions. We did put some money into an account, and I think we put about $10 million that we refurbished into that account so that we wouldn't need to call special sessions. However, if we do come back for a special session, I think we certainly could deal with the storm damage from those recent storms.
Do you have any indication from the governor as to when he could call a session?
I think it's probably a bit too early to tell. We talked initially about possibly in August, and I think the governor would like to provide some level of assurance to the resorts around the lake by letting them know that we plan to call one within a certain window. I think it's just a bit too early. Hopefully we'll know that within the next few days.
All right. Mr. Speaker, thank you for your time this morning.
Sounds great. Thank you, Kathy.
Speaker Dowd and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. Kathy talked with another lawmaker about a law change starting Saturday. It impacts families going through divorce in the state. Navigating child support and parenting time can be difficult for parents, especially when their desires conflict. And while many families choose to settle on an agreement outside of court, some turn to judges for the final say. Efforts to reform how state law operates for these cases have proven divisive at the state capitol. The law taking effect Saturday represents a compromise after years of debate. Carolyn Lane is a DFL representative from Columbia Heights. She has worked closely with other lawmakers on the effort, and she joined Kathy.
Well, this has been like the third rail of family law, very touchy, and I know you spent a lot of time on trying to reform the old law. One of the biggest changes, as I understand it, has to do with what's called best interest of the child factors used in determining custody and child support. Can you explain that for us and some of these changes?
Yes, if I could just pause a minute and go back a little bit of history of how we decide child custody. It's changed a lot in the last 45 years. In fact, before 1969, the law generally assumed custody should go to the mother if it was disputed. And then in the next 40 years, we have gradually opened things up from both parents. So advocates, as you said, from both sides of this issue of allocating parenting time have worked together with a very skilled mediator to try to get some of the kinks out of our family law processes, with the key change being, as you said, the articulating the best interests of the child factor. These best interest factors are factors the court uses to decide custody and or parenting time, both for divorcing parents and for parents that have never been married. I'll give you an example of an old one is, who is the child's primary caretaker? And a new one now is, what is the history and nature of each parent's participation in care? Another old one would be, what are the wishes of the parent? And a new one is, what are the child's physical, emotional, cultural, spiritual, and other needs, and the effect of the proposed arrangements on the child's needs and development? And it tells the courts to assume that both parents have the capacity to develop this nurturing relationship with the child.
What happens in cases where a parent just refuses to follow a decision on parenting time, taking, say, more than his or her allotted share? Are there changes there with this new law?
Yes, we put some teeth in the law. If a parent doesn't let the other parent have their parenting time due them, now the court first may give some compensatory parenting time to the parent denied, but if it's repeated and intentional, the court must not only do compensatory time, but could also add a civil penalty. And if it continues after that, the court must do a civil penalty of up to $500 and or change the attorney fees, and it could go beyond that. So we put some teeth in the law.
I know through some of my friends who do family law that the vast majority of cases are settled outside of a court using a mediator. How does this new law, these changes in law, affect those cases?
Yeah, 95% of the cases approximately are settled out of court, but the reference point for most of these is, what would the court decide if we don't get it done ourselves? So the same factors trickle down to help parents work it out.
You know, this part of family law has been, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, so very touchy and very passionate. Why has this been such a divisive issue at the Capitol?
There might be some difference of opinions about that. Part of it is the change in our culture, as I said, and there is some change around how strict we have gotten with child support, so then that plays into sometimes parents fighting over so that the money can change too. And we wanted to do a piece on the child support legislation so that the guidelines wouldn't have what we call a cliff. At a certain point, a little bit of change in time changes a lot in the dollars. But we weren't able to get that done in this year, and we're still going to work on that.
Well, Representative, thank you for your time this morning.
All right, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
Carolyn Lane and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. Governor Dayton's administration says new state health care contracts with HMOs will save taxpayers $650 million. Dayton and Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen announced the windfall yesterday, saying competitive bidding on Medicaid and Minnesota care contracts is a good way to protect state and federal taxpayer money. But the new contracts mean at least two businesses will see a dramatic loss in their revenue. Tom Scheck reports.
The state is saving money because it renegotiated the Medicaid and Minnesota Care contracts for 815,000 people enrolled with managed care organizations around the state. Starting next year, Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen says the new contracts will save the state $450 million. She also said healthcare companies will refund $200 million to the state because the people enrolled in the state-subsidized health insurance plans in 2014 weren't as sick as expected.
But today's announcement is another huge milestone of saving about $650 million in savings for federal and state taxpayers. It's a great stride. It's a great thing for taxpayers, but it's also, I think, a really good thing for our enrollees, given the quality of care that we know we are purchasing through this latest procurement.
Jessen said the state will get to keep about a third of the $650 million. The rest will be sent back to the federal government, which pays for a portion of Medicaid. The Dayton administration decided in 2011 to open the contracts to competitive bidding. In 2013, the state saved money on contracts in the 7-county metro area. In 2014, competitive bidding was done in 27 counties. This year, all 87 counties were competitively bid, and Jessen said the costs of the contracts are 15% lower than last year. In total, they say they've saved more than $1.6 billion because of the process. Governor Dayton says the competitive bidding model adopted when he first took office works.
Should have been done sooner, should have been done before we arrived.
The biggest loser as a result of the contract reshuffling is Minneapolis-based UCare. The HMO, which currently serves Medicaid clients in 58 counties, will not serve any next year.
For the company, it means the loss of 360,000 of our little over 500,000 members on January 1st.
UCare Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Marketing, Gita Wooster, says officials at the HMO were shocked the state didn't continue its contract with her company. She said UCare will remain a viable health plan, but said some of its programs could be cut, including a mobile dental unit and programs that serve immigrant communities.
And we have to figure out, you know, which ones we're going to continue and which ones make sense to continue.
Another county-based purchasing plan is also facing a major loss in business after losing out on contracts for 10 of the 11 rural counties that it serves. Leota Lind, CEO of South Country Health Alliance, says her organization will lose 85% of its membership. She said there is the potential that her organization, which is owned by counties, will close.
Yesterday, we were all just in shock and frustrated and really just trying to get our head around what this means for our members, for our counties, for our providers.
The three biggest HMOs to pick up market share as a result of the contract bids are Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, and Medica. Commissioner Jessen says her department will work to ensure that enrollees have an easy transition to the new health plans by January 1st. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
A Minnesota dentist is under fire for his part in hunting and killing a popular lion in Zimbabwe earlier this month. Walter Palmer of Eden Prairie says he regrets the killing, but in a statement says he secured proper permits and believes the hunt was legal. Authorities in Zimbabwe say Palmer is wanted in the country for poaching. John Collins has been covering the story, and he talked with Tom Cran last night on All Things Considered.
So first, what do we know about what happened here?
We know that Walter James Palmer, he's a dentist from Eden Prairie, was part of a hunting expedition at the beginning of the month, and that somehow they killed a lion that is a very, very popular symbol of Zimbabwe and also a very popular attraction at the national park there.
Cecil is the lion's name, a known animal nationally, and would be a reason for people actually to visit the park.
That's right. And it seems Cecil had a very distinctive black mane. He was very large. You know, he was also, I think it's worth noting, part of a research study, relatively high-profile one from Oxford University. So he was quite well known.
And he would have had a tag or a collar for that research?
That's right.
So what did Dr. Palmer here of Eden Prairie actually say in his statement? He admits to killing the lion, right?
Well, he admits to killing it, but he regrets killing this particular animal. He says that if he had known that it was a very popular animal or that it was part of a research project, that he would not have killed it.
You've spoken to him today. The story is getting a lot of international attention. What is your impression of how he's dealing with this?
Well, I talked to him three or four times earlier, and he was not very forthcoming necessarily, but he did seem very stressed out, very pressured, which makes sense considering that there's quite a bit of outrage online about this particular killing of this lion.
Now, according to Zimbabwe, what did they say about what happened and what is he wanted for?
So essentially what happened is Palmer hired hunting guides and a party for something around $50,000 to go out with him near the national park and hunt for a big game, and lions in this case. Zimbabwe officials say they attached a dead animal to the back of a vehicle at night, and they lured it out of the national park, where I think that's part of the controversy, is they took it out of a place where it was protected, brought it into a place where it was not protected. They then shot it with bow and arrow. It was wounded. About 40 hours later, they finally tracked it down. They killed it with a firearm, skinned it, beheaded it, took off its collar. What Zimbabwe police are saying right now is he is facing charges of poaching. We haven't seen anything official come down, and he also says that he has not received any notice from authorities either in Zimbabwe or in the United States, and that he's willing to cooperate with them.
So this isn't the first time that Palmer has been involved in controversy over hunting, is it?
No, he's had a little bit of history with that. In Wisconsin in 2008, he pleaded guilty to killing a black bear outside the area where he was permitted to hunt them. And in Minnesota, there was a minor infraction where he was cited in 2003 for fishing without a license.
Now, if he's wanted in Zimbabwe, do we know if he's still in the country or his whereabouts at this point?
We don't know. As I said, when I spoke to him earlier three or four times, he was not communicative. His statement did not really give us much information apart from his essential regrets and belief that he was not breaking the law.
John Collins, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's more about the story online today from John and from the NewsCut blog at nprnews.org.
John Collins and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. Speaking of hunting for the second straight year, it's going to be tough for hunters to kill a deer this fall in Minnesota. The DNR has warned hunters to expect another conservative hunting season as the agency continues to work to rebuild the size of the state's whitetail herd. Dan Crocker reports.
For many deer hunters across the state, Craig Engwall's experience hunting last fall about 50 miles northwest of Grand Rapids was typical.
I hunted about 5 days pretty solid, and I did not see any deer.
Last year, the DNR established rules for the state's most conservative deer hunting season in 20 years. This year will be similar. Now, you might think that deer hunters would be rather unhappy about another hunting season facing longer odds to shoot a deer. And in fact, many hunters are upset with how the agency is setting deer population goals. But Engwall, who directs the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, says his group supports the DNR's hunting plan this year.
We're taking a long-term look at things, and we would much rather have a little more difficulty getting a deer this year and instead build a stable herd for the future.
Hunters this year will only be allowed to kill one deer in over 90% of the state. In more than half the state's 128 deer permit areas, hunters will have to enter a lottery to shoot a female deer. And in much of northern Minnesota, hunters will again only be allowed to shoot bucks. DNR Big Game Program Leader Leslie McEnany says those regulations will increase the number of fawns born in the spring.
We've heard from a lot of people that they'd like to see more deer across the landscape. Hopefully, people will start seeing the results of our efforts this season.
Last year, hunters killed about 139,000 deer. That's the lowest harvest in over 20 years. She expects the harvest this year to be between 140 and 155,000 deer. McEnany says last year's conservative harvest and some recent milder winters are already helping deer numbers.
Hunters should be seeing more deer in many parts of the state this fall. We've got good reports coming from around the state on fawn production and deer conditions. That's really good news.
That's also good news for the Fond du Lac Ojibwe in northeast Minnesota. Wildlife biologist Mike Schrag says the band hasn't set hunting regulations yet for this fall, but he says last year they cut their harvest on the reservation to fewer than 200 deer.
Deer are the band's bread and butter subsistence animal, and the band is hoping to see more deer in the area.
For the past 3 years, the DNR has met with stakeholders across the state to set new deer population goals. In many areas, the agency is calling for 25% to 50% increases over last year's numbers. The Minnesota Deer Hunters Association says the state should be more aggressive. The group wants to reach an annual harvest of around 225,000 animals. The DNR says it will consider that goal, but only after an audit of its deer management program is completed early next year. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Events are planned in Minnesota this week and next to mark the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The landmark federal law banned literacy tests, poll taxes, and other discriminatory barriers that African-American voters were facing at the time in the South. Minnesotans who were involved in getting the law passed and others are reflecting on its impact. And as Tim Pugmire reports, they're also highlighting the work they see as unfinished.
As a young girl in Texas, civil rights pioneer and educator Josie Johnson helped her father gather signatures on petitions to try to abolish that state's poll tax. Johnson, who later moved to Minnesota, finally saw discriminatory voting rules outlawed when she was in her 30s with the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
We finally got the legal right to cast a vote. And I believe as a citizen, casting your vote and being able to express your wishes regarding critical issues and people is what citizenship is all about. So for me, this is a historic moment.
Soon after the violent attack on marchers in Selma, Alabama, President Lyndon Johnson called on Congress to take strong action to end voter disenfranchisement. Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law on August 6, 1965.
Today is a triumph for freedom, as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield.
The six Democrats and four Republicans who made up Minnesota's congressional delegation at the time stood united in support of voting rights. Republican Al Quie, now 91, represented Minnesota's 1st District.
I think it was one of the great significant things we did. What really could be greater than protecting your right to vote? Now you've got a voice in government. That means democracy can work.
Democrat Donald Fraser, who is also 91, represented Minnesota's 5th District.
It was a major step in helping improve our system of government.
There are two more surviving members of Minnesota's 1965 congressional delegation, Walter Mondale and Alec Olson. All four will be honored Thursday afternoon in St. Paul during an event to mark the Voting Rights Act anniversary. Josie Johnson will also be honored. Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon, the host of the event, said the recognition is well-deserved.
There was widespread disagreement within the congressional delegation on so many issues, but on this issue, a signal issue of its time and a very important moral issue, all Minnesotans in Congress came together, and of course Josie Johnson, a noted civil rights activist, was right there with those members of Congress, and we want to honor them. We want to say thank you.
Simon said the anniversary is also an opportunity to look ahead and take steps to enhance voting rights. As the state's top elections official, Simon is advocating for more early voting options, pre-registration for high school students, and the restoration of voting rights for convicted felons who've completed their sentences.
I think the key thing is to discuss ways we can always be improving access to the polls, making sure that all eligible voters in Minnesota get that chance.
The Voting Rights Act required some southern states and local jurisdictions to get federal approval before changing election laws. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down that section of the law 2 years ago. Minnesota Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison remains concerned about the 2013 ruling. Ellison, who is the first African American to represent Minnesota in Congress, said the court watered down the act and opened the door to more of the photo identification laws that he opposes.
They know that there are a lot of low-income people, a lot of people of color, a lot of seniors, people who they don't want to vote, students who don't have a government-issued ID. So they want to push these things to exclude people.
This week, in advance of the Voting Rights Act anniversary, Ellison introduced federal legislation that would prohibit photo ID requirements to vote. He also introduced a bill to require same-day registration in all federal elections. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
And that's the NPR News Update for Wednesday. I'm Phil Picardi. Again, starting mid-next week, the NPR News Update format is changing. More details coming.